go over to that neighboring town or village and kill every man, woman, and child in there, would you please? It's like, what is that? That is, if that's not something that wants to be exclusively paid attention to and have all intention, thought, prayer focused at that male patriarchal and fire elemental, it's a that's a fire deity. Like it always shows up as a burning bush or a column of fire, which also, let's swing this into the whole narrative, the spiritual sci-fi narrative. There's also a lot of anxiety around losing things that are fire-based currently in our culture. We're talking about the irrational fear of losing a gas stove, the internal combustion engine, guns, gun control, all of these issues that the patriarchal power structure is saying, I'm going to protect it. It's the patriarchal fire-based flame pact and covenant that was made. Like, you keep this, you take care of this, and it'll take care of you. Well, things like, electric-based, renewable energy economies, equity economies that honor women. This is all a threat to that covenant. And that's, you see, irrational anxieties around stuff like, they're going to take away your gas stove. It's like, yeah, we're at a point in our human evolution when we don't have to set things on fire to be taken care of. You know what I mean? We're kind of beyond that. You know what I'm saying? But it's so deep in our kind of evolutionary conscious that the man with the fire will take care of us.
Hey everyone, and welcome. Thanks for being here today. And thank you, Benjamin, for coming to chat with me. Benjamin Lauder is a scholar of Buckminster Fuller, currently writing a book on him, as well as a visual artist who repurposes old materials to create something new, and a by default house designer architect.
Out of necessity for shelter, yeah.
Right. You created a home for yourself based on sacred geometry and using techniques learned from Buckminster and Fuller, as well as studied from nature to create a home that's passively better for the environment with heating and cooling techniques and also very aesthetically pleasing.
Funny how that happens. They go hand in hand.
Yeah. Did I cover all the bases? I know it's
Oh,
hard to
that's
pin down someone who's an artist. You just express
yeah.
yourself in different ways.
Yeah, that's what I've been just going with. Just artist. Aren't we're all artists in our own way, right? So the
Yeah.
art of living. Artful living, is that what I'm engaged with?
Especially if we leave a career behind. You used to be in marketing, correct?
I did, yeah. That's a lot of creative people or people who are artistic find that, they can pay the bills by creating advertising and things. Or at least that's what happened for me early on in my career. Graphic design, illustration, logo design, and marketing. But yeah, I kind of very intentionally stopped doing that and left it behind. After the home design that you described, I went through that process and it was pretty enlightening. Just to build a house that was in alignment with nature rather than in opposition to it, oriented towards seasonal sun angles rather than oriented towards curb appeal. Very different kind of process, and it was a really enlightening experience that made me say, like, okay, I don't want to give away my talent anymore to people whom I don't necessarily even want to see succeed. Like, I want to champion these values of the things that I discovered through the process of the home design, which were fee ratios, sacred geometry, and by using reclaimed materials, just kind of like understanding that, preserving that heritage of the material, effort that went into growing the tree, that went into creating the lumber, like, sourcing those reclaimed materials out of old barns and things was also a very kind of enlightening experience. That if we did more of that, there would be huge ripple effects that go out in positive ways. After that process of designing and building the home, also, I was reintroduced to the legacy of Buckminster Fuller. And I had known him before because I attended Southern Illinois University Carbondale, which is where he taught in the 60s and 70s. But you know, he had passed away since when I got there. But his legacy, you know, was on campus. His home is right there near campus. The Fuller Dome home, it's in a museum now. You can check it out at fullerdome.org. I'm also on the board of that to help preserve that, which it has been. And now we're building a visitor center. But at the time, you know, as a teenager going to college, it was like encountering his legacy there. It just seemed like a novel shape, right? It's like, oh, it's cool. It's round instead of square. That's neat. And not really kind of like understanding why or the philosophical stuff behind it until building my own house that I was trying to align with seasonal sun angles and work with, you know, the natural environment to naturally heat and cool it. And then the Dome Home, his house down there, reached out and asked if I would help him with marketing stuff. And so getting reintroduced to his legacy after having that experience of building something that is trying to be in alignment with nature felt like, oh, wow, I get it now. That's what he was doing. And that this interestingly enough, this is all about 2012, you know, when you know, the whole millennial kind of fervor was happening about the Mayan calendar ending. And you know, of course, you know, personally, it did feel like a whole new world emerged for me around that same time, and I've been on that trajectory ever since. And like you mentioned, the art practice is also kind of an extension of that, in that you know, you can see some examples of it behind me here. This is an old metal Orange Crush sign that's deconstructed, chopped up into the triangulation pattern that evokes the sacred geometry and the geometry of the geodesic domes. And but it's also kind of personal in that I'm deconstructing advertising, and I started that exactly at this time when I decided I wasn't going to do advertising anymore, except for on behalf of people like Bucky, and you know, promote that kind of a legacy. So yeah, so now fast forward, you know, a good decade plus, a dozen years or so, working in this medium and promoting Fuller's legacy. Now I'm the director at the Center for Spirituality and Sustainability Dome that he built on the campus of Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. And it's a miniature Earth geodesic dome that you can go into, and when you're standing in the center of it and you look up, you look at the place, you're looking at the place you're standing on, the actual planet. So it's this really kind of transcendent fractal kind of thing from the human individual looking up at their place in the world. And since it's translucent, you look out into the cosmos to see the world's place in the universe. So it was really incredible. The first time I went there, I had this really kind of powerful experience of that. You know, if you're a imaginative person, you can easily feel that. You almost expect to see the bottom of your feet looking up. You know, it's like, oh wow, I'm looking from the heart of the planet up at myself. It's like an out of body kind of thing where you become the perceiver and the perceived. It's very moving place to visit. So now I'm the director there and working a lot with the estate of Buckminster Fuller. And just, you know, to use a Bucky word, got good synergy between the visual art and the architecture and the promotion and professional life. So that's where I'm at today.
That's so exciting. Did your investment in alchemy come in around the same time? Because I met you at the Philosophical Research Society, which was founded by Manly P. Hall. You were doing a talk, The Math, Myth, and Magic. And you referenced in that talk discovering Manly P. Hall. And then at, you know, what point did you discover him? At what point did you tie in the fact that Bucky was invested also in alchemy and the spiritual?
Yeah, it's an interest. He integrates kind of that intuitive and rational, the artistic and scientific, you know, in one person. But because he, you know, he has 30 patents that, you know, are all based on math and science and engineering, he gets that reputation that he's just this rational man of science, you know, seeking concrete solutions for the world. And he is, but what like lots of scientists from, you know, Newton to Copernicus to, you know, Giordano Bruno, they're on a mystic quest And the scientific discoveries and things like that are almost like side quests. You know, they're almost like things that he discovered while trying, in his words, to understand the coordinating system operative in universe. You know, someone else might say, understand the creator's hand, or understand the nature of God, or understand how you know, nature, sacred geometry can reveal the creator's hand in the material world. But you know, he thought of universe in that sense. And you know, so in terms of alchemy, you know that it's very basic level transformation. That is something that I, you know, you hear Carl Jung talk about it from a psychological standpoint, you know, but he's kind of just using the alchemical language in a psychological way. You know, he did that a lot, like co-opting other types of language. But this also all is really kind of downstream from designing the house. Trying to figure out how to build without relying totally on modern heating and air conditioning. I'm a migraine headache sufferer, and I wanted to create an environment free of migraine headaches. So that would be no VOCs, which is like petroleum-based products, creating fumes in the environment, lots of natural light, good thermal dynamics. So through trying to create a space for myself and my family that was clean and free of things that would trigger migraine headaches for me, I kind of went looking at how people built before the Industrial Revolution. And through that kind of research process, you know, you're talking about like ancient structures that got a lot of consideration seem to have these reoccurring proportions in them that were based off of phi ratios, not pi, but phi, 1.618, and it goes on forever. And, you know, that's kind of the basis, that proportion is the basis of a lot of natural growth structure. So just in researching how to build a house in alignment with nature and looking at ancient building practices and ancient, which were a lot of times invested in sacred spaces, phi ratios came up. And I thought, oh, there's something there that's interesting. I just kind of put a pin in it and came back to it later. But in that, trying to understand what was operative or going on there with these phi ratios that I was just, you know, coming across while researching how to build in alignment with nature, that is when I kind of discovered the Manly P. Hall legacy. And then while doing the art practice, I would of course found Secret Teachings of All Ages, read through it several times, and then just started listening to it compulsively in his lectures while doing this work, that, you know, the artwork, like deconstructing it and cutting it up and folding it and bending it and then reassembling it. And in getting his descriptions about alchemy, it just dawned on me while physically doing the work that the art practice was an alchemical practice, that the original piece of advertising that, and I found a lot of these that were like on old buildings that I salvaged to build the house. You might, like a farmer, if their barn was near Route 66, which is near us, would, you know, have a big metal Orange Crush sign, like the one behind me, on the side of it. And then, you know, over time, you know, change hands, and then they would take that big sheet of metal and say, patch the roof of the barn. Or it would be in the barn, you know what I mean? Not necessarily on the outside of it anymore. And then, so I had found a bunch of these, and I thought, well, I should do something with them. But I never brought myself to like hang them in the house. And they were just kind of stacked up in the garage. And, you know, around the time when advertising started looking like a more of a manipulative practice, where, you know, using word magic and spelling to cause people to feel like they didn't have enough, and, you know, to just promote anxiety and drive consumerism, they seemed like things that needed to be, you know, subverted. So cutting them up was the in the alchemical steps would been like the solvay, or the breaking apart of the bonds, or in the process of, say, like a caterpillar turning into a butterfly fly when it, you know, becomes liquefied before it turns into its new thing. And then, you know, through the creative process of, reimagining it. The language is broken, the spells are broken of the advertising. It's been transmuted, and then the coagula, or the bringing back together part of the alchemical process that Manly P. Hall was talking about in these lectures while I'm listening. I'm like, oh wow, that's the step when I take the old pieces and fragments and artifacts and then turn them back into some visual object that reinforces these new values like reuse, sacred geometry, triangulation, and the legacy of Buckminster Fuller. So that's kind of the how alchemy applies to the whole process. And really to the house too, because it's all built out of reclaimed materials, recycled steel. And so it's, I mean, everything, our in the Tao, our digestion is more of their alchemical place, where the material comes in, is transmuted, is turned into something else. And then, through your actions and life and behavior, that's like the result of that alchemical process. But, everything is like everything, even in our body, has gone through the alchemical transformation. Like all of our cells and atoms were something previously, and they went through the crucible of time and then came out to us. So it seemed to apply, and it applies broadly.
I mean, there's no escaping alchemy. It's in everything. I've been unpacking alchemical symbology in Taylor Swift music videos. And it's very clear that she's doing it on purpose, but you can see it anywhere and everywhere, people doing it on purpose or not on purpose. It often arises unconsciously because it's just the nature of things.
Yeah, it's like, that's why these things stand the test of time in wisdom traditions, because they've hit some sort of bedrock of truth of like, yeah, that's how things work on this third dimensional material existence on Earth, like an alchemical process is one of those.
So what is the nature of God?
For me,
subject.
I have a fairly, specific idea of God, and you hate to even use the word God because it's like so loaded with detritus, of a patriarchal male, anthropomorphic figure, the thou shalt Yahweh figure from our Judeo-Christian Western tradition. That is not God to me, obviously. I mean, if that has any truth to it, that character would be some kind of a demigod, or possibly the demiurge. That character knows enough about the source of things. And source is cool. That's kind of gotten to be a little bit of a new agey term. So anytime you arrive at something that a word, a symbol to stand for God, it's obviously going to be inadequate. So, but I currently, I would be thinking of like the unmanifested first cause that informs everything that happens from it materially, but it's not, it's unmanifested. So, we're living in obviously a manifested world, but this unmanifested first cause resides at that like point between what science calls like the Big Bang or the Great Expansion, and then it goes out in that toroidal shape, and then eventually collapses back down into the Big Crunch. So between the Big Bang and the Big Crunch, at the middle of that torus, there is a unmanifested first cause that is in equilibrium there, without longing for being born or without longing for showing up materially, and that we have a connection to it through our heart that goes back, at a basically like a, goes through the middle of the torus back to that unmanifested first cause, because of the evidenced by the toroidal shape of our electromagnetic field of our heart shows up there. But so that's kind of a windy, long way of describing what I would picture as God, or the first cause, or the prime mover, the unmanifested spot of equilibrium between expansion and contraction of the universe, The material world's going out on the surface of this torus, and the non-material world is connected by ethereal strands from the heart of whatever, the mineral, the plant, the animal, the whatever, to that place. And whenever some aspect of that first cause has longing for showing up, gets born, goes down one of those ethereal strands on the surface of this shape to be born at a time, which is really just a location on this shape, because it's all happening simultaneously. The Big Bang, the crunch, now, you know, because it's an object. It's not linear. So anyway, yeah.
That's excellent. That's a great description. And, you know, when we pass, we like go back, right? Like the experience is just kind of cycling all the time.
Yeah. I don't know. I've thought about that too. I don't think it's the same every time, obviously, right? Because it's like, you know, the material gets drawn back down into that big crunch. And then, scientists describe, like, if you went into a black hole, there's that spaghettification thing where like all your atoms get lined up in a single line. So that's like what happens probably after the big crunch. There's like that. They just get down to their primal constituent spot and then ejected back out. Actually, I'm going to say ejected back out as a downward thing, you know, out, you know, like almost like, you know, excretion or, you know, out. And then they start to just reorganize and do those primal geometric evolution of, like, you know, connection, those primal connections that Bucky was so obsessed with in understanding, that he called the coordinating system of universe or nature's coordinating system, that is unseen and there and governing the recurring proportions present in sacred geometry. You know, so you're down to, like, you know, the Platonic solid proportions and, you know, tetrahedrons, octahedrons, dodecahedron, and those, you know, icosahedron, those shapes, those proportions are like the first things that start happening when those little, you know, spaghettified atoms start to then reconnect. And then, yeah, anyway, that's how I picture it currently.
Amazing.
Maybe different next year.
Well, it sounds like there is a set structure to the material world.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least based on everything that we know or everything that we've perceived thus far through our human point of view.
Yeah. 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 Through our sensory capacity. Even if, you know, Korzybski, like, saying, you know, the map is not the territory, or our sensory impression of the world is not the actual world. It's what we have, you know, and that's kind of like what Bucky's questing to understand: the invisible forces that are acting on the material that cause them to grow in these predictable patterns. He thought it was something unseen that's in the void of space, but the void isn't a void. It's beyond our sensory capacity. So, like in this book I'm writing, the thing I use to illustrate that is that, and we've all probably done this, one time I was like on a hill and there was a pasture and I could see enough land where I could see the wind. I could see the wind because it was blowing through this tall grass. I could see the start and end of it. And it had like this specific shape and it like moved across the landscape, right? Affecting the material world of the grass, the invisible wind. So all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, I can see it. You know, I could see something that was formerly unseen because of how it's interacting with the material world. And that's kind of like Bucky's quest to, like, you know, there's this, what he called universe's, you know, coordinating system, this invisible space around things dictating the proportions of their growth, whether it's the mineral growth or the animal growth or the plant growth. And all, you know, it all follows these phi ratios and predictable proportions. So there's, you know, and that was his whole thing. Like, if our human-made creations echo and are in alignment with that, then they will be blessed. They'll be anointed. They'll be durable. They'll be strong. They will be efficient, because that is what is dictated, you know, by this invisible force. So, you know, things like the geodesic dome, which he patented in 1954, And the most famous example of that's maybe like Epcot. But you know, it's that triangulated lattice that creates a sphere. Thanks to the coronavirus hitting, everyone saw that graphic on the news of that sphere of the coronavirus with protein spikes sticking out of it. Well, the underlying structure is a geodesic sphere underneath the coronavirus, and all virus shells are based off of that same geometry, which is actually an icosahedron. So, like, if you're into role playing, the die that you would use for Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that, 20 faces, 20, platonic solid, all, so at least the class of viruses that the coronavirus is, the underlying geometry is an icosahedron, because that's like one of the primary. That's why it's so strong. That's why it's such a durable container for whatever a virus is. And a geodesic sphere is a bloated icosahedron with the faces triangulated. It's probably a little deep in the geometry weeds for some viewers, but there's probably one person out there enjoying
I'm gonna just
that.
take it even more obscure right
Good. Yeah.
now. It's
Please.
so interesting that 2020 is the year that the coronavirus became known to the public, and Bucky's magical number was 22.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, that was relayed to me by his family, like his grandson. That was just one of those things that he felt like the 22, when it would show up, was with the universe winking or nodding to them. So, and when you once you if anyone's done that or observed that, then it just you get the feedback gets stronger and stronger and stronger. So, yeah, well, that's interesting, because you said 2020 when the coronavirus hits, and the icosahedron has 20 faces, 20 equilateral triangles on it. So, some numerology synchronicities there.
And I like the number 22 also because there's 21, well, there's 22 cards in the major arcana. It's like
Right, yeah.
0 to 21. So there's something in that number that's quite.
It's true. It's true. Yeah, there's some relations to the phonetic alphabet, to slight variations away from it, around it. But that's kind of the thing, like why these numbers, why are these reoccurring numbers, like 12, 360, 60, 72, 108. Like, these are all like, 108 is like the guru number. And these numbers like show up across the planet and all these different wisdom traditions as these special numbers. It's like, but it is really just people who did deep dives, our ancestors who, undistracted from technology and observing nature and observing patterns, it's all based off of this same geometry, in this spherical geometry in particular. Just the example of 12, like, Bucky was really into this concept of the closest packing of spheres idea. And then you could connect the interior of those spheres and get all the different platonic solids. And the shape that he was particularly interested in, which it's called a cubo-octahedron or the vector equilibrium, but that's a whole discussion in itself. If you want to Google vector equilibrium, please do. But one example of it is like the icosahedron, that the role-playing die shape is the middle of all the corners of it would be 12 spheres around one in the center. So this concept of 12 around one, 12 houses of the zodiac around the sun, 12 disciples around the son of God or the Messiah. These are, this is all just encoding this geometry that governs the material natural world into anthropomorphic mythological stories that relay that information to people who don't have the time, patience, or want to dive into the myth, math, and the magic of it all, right? You can just create stories and holidays and plays, theater, and get everybody's attention galvanized at the correct auspicious occasions on these subjects. It helps feed information into that universal macro organism that we're here, we're paying attention, we appreciate these rhythms, we appreciate these patterns, we want these seasons to continue, we want this way supports and nurtures this. Thank you. Rather than turning our back on it and no longer sending that message out, you know, then maybe, you know, that's why seasons are getting out of whack. We're not doing that. We're not acknowledging that. There's cynicism has crept in, you know, that's all hokey superstition of the past. And but, you know, who knows? Our little human mind may be sending something up in a, you know, electromagnetic thought wave way to the macro organism that's saying, yes, continue these, you know, predictable, stable environment and seasons for these little organisms. And if we're just preoccupied with our own creation of screens and entertainment, and we're forgetting to do that, then maybe the seasons get out of whack as a result. I've noticed too, it's like, it seems, I don't know, you know, there's these tropes in our society of like the dark magician, or like the person in league, you know, practicing magic is in league with the devil, or a lot of right-wing governments use magic. And that's true. And it appears to be true. Like even our current president in the United States here in 2025, you know, there's a lot of people deliberately practicing meme magic and online magic that helped bring him about. And his father went to their church, would have been like Norman Vincent Peale, you know, who was like, who preached the power of thought and don't give any attention to the things that you don't want to be true. And at some point that's just, you're lying. That's just lying. And I think at the heart of all that is like people who do want to manipulate use those tools because the truth isn't on their side. So they have to use manipulative practices. That's not to say that the tools are wrong or corrupt, but the people who have data and truth on their side don't feel the need to use that stuff. But the problem is, that's not how the world works, and that's not how the human mind works, and that's not how we arrive at our consciousness and shape our reality. We shape it off of emotions and stories and narratives and all the things that advertising and those types of people traffic in. It would be nice if the people with, you know, truth and data and love on their side would use those same communication tools to be more effective at getting our world, you know, kind of like moving in the more cooperative direction instead of this kind of conflict-driven, fear-based direction. I guess in that vein, you know, kind of going back to your old question of like, what is your conception of God? You know, and, you know, the, you know, Judeo-Christian God being possibly some sort of demigod. I mean, I do tend to believe that there are, we could call them demigods or some sort of beings that are on some sort of a extra dimensional layer that do have a vested interest in the collective consciousness of human beings or the collective consciousness of inhabited planets, you know, in that it seems like maybe they're somehow nourished by the collective emotional off-putting, and that fear and conflict maybe almost like some sort of quick and easy junk food version that some of these entities or extra dimensional beings find easier to be nourished by. And possibly there are other ones that want the more cooperative, you know, love, security based emotional off-putting that is more of like the health food. That's maybe it's like, well, it's harder to get and it's like takes longer, but you know, it's supportive of the whole kind of organism, from them down to us, down to the animal, down to the plant, down to the mineral. You know, it's like, and not, you're just going for this quick kind of grab of like, let's just cause chaos and fear, and let's support the agents on that dimensional plane that are supporting and creating chaos and fear. Might explain why it seems like some of these negative or fear-based agents at work currently seem to be really lucky. You know, things seem to sure go their way at a rate that defies Any kind of sensible logic of what should be happening, certain faith groups be like, oh yeah, that's because they're anointed and blessed, and their effort is, what are they anointed and blessed by? You know what I'm saying? Is it when you're trying to sow conflict and resist mercy, I think that you're probably adding to the collective fear, emotional off-putting of the planet that would be nourishing a more nefarious extra-dimensional being. So that's a bit of a kind of a spiritual sci-fi story. I have to tell myself these stories in order to kind of make sense of the world that is seems insane. But these stories kind of help, I think, for me personally.
It rings really true, and I do think there may be science that can back this up when we understand that gods or demigods, the demiurge, is the product of a whole bunch of people who believe in him.
Right, like a
And
golem, or an egregore.
exactly, right, like the concept that like something exists because you believe it exists.
That's I think that's a pretty good theory. That if, which is, for lack of a better word, if these entities, these thought-based entities, have some sort of non-material existence, or at least to our sensory capacity, it's non-material. And they are nourished by emotions and collective thought of, communities, nations, planets. Then, that is the level that they're operative at, and they're dependent upon that for nourishment and sustenance and survival. When you look at the old biblical stories of encountering Yahweh, I mean, he, very specific, male deity, was like, you will focus all your attention on me and no one else at all. And if you do that, then I will smite your enemies. Go over to that neighboring town or village and kill every man, woman, and child in there, would you please? It's like, what is that? That is, if that's not something that wants to be exclusively paid attention to and have all intention, thought, prayer focused at that male patriarchal and fire elemental, it's that's a fire deity. Like it always shows up as a burning bush or a column of fire, which also, let's swing this into the whole narrative, the spiritual sci-fi narrative. There's also a lot of anxiety around losing things that are fire-based currently in our culture. We're talking about the irrational fear of losing a gas stove, the internal combustion engine, guns. Gun control, all of these issues that the patriarchal power structure is saying, I'm going to protect it. It's the patriarchal fire-based flame pact and covenant that was made. Like, you keep this, you take care of this, and it'll take care of you. Well, things like, electric-based, renewable energy economies, equity economies that honor women, and this is all a threat to that covenant. And that's, you see, irrational anxieties around stuff like they're going to take away your gas stove. It's like, yeah, we're at a point in our human evolution when we don't have to set things on fire to be taken care of. You know what I mean? We're kind of beyond that. You know what I'm saying? But it's so deep in our kind of evolutionary conscious that the man with the fire will take care of us. Well, his time's up. He's done. And he's freaking the freak out right now, He's like, okay, I'm gonna burn it all down if I can't be in charge. Well, it's the age of Aquarius. That is over. This is a creative, integrative era that the divine feminine is coming forward, and it's inevitable. And I just hope we live long enough to see it. So, but anyway.
Me too. I have a lot of faith that we're already seeing it. We're going to see more and more of it. It's just a pretty cataclysmic time. And the Yahweh character, he's been setting fire to things for so long, including from the beginning, the goddess. He was stomping around from day one saying like, no, Ashirsh's got to go, like go destroy the temples, like, and that's what we're seeing today. I'd love if you could share a little bit about Bucky's aunt, because
Speaking of the goddess, yeah.
yeah, speaking of the goddess, and Bucky had so much to say about using the forces instead of fighting them and building a new paradigm. And I think that's really, really wise counsel for our times right now, when it's so easy to get distracted by the men stomping around and causing all of this destruction and desperately holding on for control. The last thing we want to do is feed that demiurge, feed them with with our fear, and with our insecurity. So how can we shift our perspective to building the new?
Yeah, it does feel like these values, like what you mentioned, Buckminster Fuller's aunt, Margaret Fuller, she in a lot of ways was the United States' first feminist, and she was the editor of the Dial, which was the Transcendentalists journal. You know, we're talking Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau. She was really, really intelligent and enlightened person who had a deep understanding of the real function of mythology, similar to the way that I described, you know, like that it's in encoding deep truths with a capital T into, you know, it's anthropomorphizing those concepts for the masses and creating allegories to contain that. So that has transmitted across empires cr rising and falling, these stories. So it's like her, you know, transmitting and continuing to transmit and understand the true nature of mythology and inform those guys around her, like Emerson. You know, she was their matriarch. They drew a ton of inspiration from her. I mean, in Buckminster Fuller, although, you know, she died in the 1840s in a boating accident off the coast of Fire Island when she was coming back from Italy. And he was born in 1895, so they, you know, they missed each other by a few decades. But she wrote Woman of the 19th Century. You know, she was well written and published, so he could learn about her that way. And he said that she's had the most influence on his life than anyone else. But you know, she gave a report to a newspaper in New York that it was kind of like a journal, a travel journal. She took a train ride from the East Coast to Illinois, where I'm at, to near Rockford, Illinois. And she could, it was almost like a 21st century person embodied in the 1840s, where, you know, she was seeing lumber stacked at all the train depots and saying, people are behaving as though these resources are limitless, but there is a finite amount of this. And she was seeing, you know, indigenous people losing their life ways and, you know, begging at train depots and drunk, and she mourned the loss of all of that knowledge about how that those folks have had over the generations about how to live on, you know, what they would call Turtle Island, or, you know, this landmass, the United States. And yeah, so she was an abolitionist, environmentalist, it was an incredible person. And you know, she died way too soon. And because of the sexism of the time, didn't get the same kind of notoriety as, you know, Emerson, Hawthorne, Thoreau, like all of those people. She would have been teaching at Harvard. You know, their family was a deep, you know, five generations of Harvard people. And but instead, she was holding discussions in drawing rooms of houses in Cambridge where Harvard professors were coming, and, you know, and debating and getting bested by her intelligence. But yeah, Margaret Fuller, unsung American hero and inspiration to lots of people, including her nephew, Buckminster Fuller.
During your talk, you showed the cover of her book, which is the Ouroboros around a hexagram.
Yeah, incredible, right? I mean, if that it doesn't say it right there. Yeah, it is a particularly good Ouroboros too, with a white snake in you know, then a black one. Or no, the snake is complete, but the triangles that create the hexagram are black and white. Again, like the kind of the integration of that alchemical kind of Solvay and Coagula, the polarities showing up in that masculine, feminine, black and white. And that's what they, again, with the alchemical tradition, you hear in the news everybody using the word polarization. It's like that is the buzzword to describe the last nearly a decade now. Extreme polarization. But within the alchemical tradition, the polarization happens right before the transformation. And now I only have to look out and see, obviously, it's things are being transformed. I hope for the better. I mean, I the long arc, it will be for the better. I just hope that we see that, in our lifespan, we see the other side of it and not just this harsh liminal in between space that we're going through right now. And that's kind of like how you can put the context of the current president's malpractice and incompetence, that he is the, he is the liquefying destructive agent, that, in some ways maybe is necessary for transformation. Not the transformation they think they're bringing about, but they, they're serving a purpose, a higher purpose. Like you see all the different things that get attracted to them like a magnet are all the things that kind of need to perish, the old paradigm. And it's just unfortunate that it kind of looks like a lot of the structure of what the United States was and never like fully lived up to, or its own aspirations, is part of the things that are getting liquefied in this alchemical transmutation process. Yeah, it's vulnerable, dangerous crossing. It's a vulnerable spot we're in. So we got to transmit those old wisdom traditions, that like what Margaret Fuller did, that people saying we have been through this before. This is cyclical, and these are the values. These are the truths. This is reality. This is the true nature of the world. Don't be seduced by human-made creation. That it's all just a simulacrum of the actual creation. And yeah, that's what the project is, to get you divorced from your connection with that source of things, and caught up in the fear and anger cycles, and feed that collective nefarious extra dimensional being that somehow nourished by fear and conflict. So anyway, yeah, it all fits together nicely, doesn't it?
Sure does.
Yeah.
It's so deeply uncomfortable, and
Right.
in the moments when we're ungrounded, so terrifying.
Totally. Yeah. Which is, I don't know. It's hard to know what to do. It's hard to know where to put your energy. Where, right now I'm busy creating an event that we're going to have in the Fuller Dome, that miniature Earth Dome on the campus of SIU Edwardsville, that is, kind of bringing together all these ideas around unity, cooperation, bringing back Bucky's world game, which is this where you roll out his Dymaxion map on the floor, a huge version of it, and have people stand on it to represent global population across the world. And then you assign them actual resources, that's like breadsticks and cans of oil well, barrels and or water. And then, they have to figure out, and like, oh, I don't have any water, but you've got, whatever, you've got oil. Let's exchange. And then like the point of it is to avert conflict. And so that was something that he, came up with while he was a professor at SIU. And then the other thing is the World Resource Simulation Center, which is the same thing, but like kind of modeling, global resource inventory and global population distribution. And he proposed it for to be outside the UN, that you would make sure that everyone had enough to fulfill his kind of stated goal of making the world work for 100% of humanity through spontaneous cooperation without disadvantage to anyone or ecological offense. So that's the mission. So It feels good to have that to invest time in. It's happening on the weekend before March 31st, which is the 90th day of the year. And the dome, as well as his Dymaxion map, use the 90th longitudinal meridian as their central line of reference. The Dymaxion map uses it as its spine. It just so happened to pass through the land that became that university before he ever was a professor there. And then the building that was planned for the one that got built as the Fuller Dome got scrapped. And then he got to step in and build this miniature Earth over the actual 90th meridian. So that's how you can walk into it, stand in the middle, and then look up. The miniature Earth is rotated so that its 90th is over the actual 90th. So on the 90th day, on the 90th meridian, that's what we'll be doing there. So that's a good thing to put some energy into.
That's so powerful. This map is so cool. I was watching it. I replayed it a couple times last night while I was watching your talk, just like watching it unfold, because we're just so used to seeing that flat rectangle of the world and everything, you know, like you said, Greenland's super stretched out, North America and Africa are really far apart, but in this map that unfolds in through sacred geometry, like he's
Again, it's an icosahedron. When it's
yeah.
folded up, it's an icosahedron. And the way he arrived at that was just taking a globe and drawing circles around it, which you like call great circles. And then where they overlapped, they could this triangulated pattern kind of emerged that he then adapted into an icosahedron. And then, so when you unfold that, there's not the distortion of, as the globe goes, as the sphere goes up, the diameter gets smaller and smaller towards the poles, so it's nothing. So the diameter is small at at the poles at the top and bottom. And when you turn that into a rectangle, which is what our classroom maps were, you stretch, you peel that off, you have to stretch the poles. So Europe, northern climates, and there's not a lot of land in the extreme southern climates, Australia, Antarctica. But coincidentally or not, it tends to be places where white people live. Look like they're bigger or more important than they actually are. And the equatorial places are shrunken where, brown and black people are at. That's just a, so when you go to create a more accurate map, is which is what he wanted to do, there's all these other little things that come out of having an accurate picture of the world. You see things correctly, things like, places in the northern climes where white people are from are sized correctly. They're shrunken back into their correct size in relationship to places like Africa. And anthropologists like it because, if people want to pull it up and Google it, you can easily see how Homo sapiens would have like kind of walked out of Africa through the Middle East, through Asia. You can, it looks like one island, the Earth, all the land on the planet is like one island, except for, outliers like Australia and a few places. But from Africa all the way to South America, when there was, a connection between Alaska and Russia for a while that was frozen over, you could walk, or you could, if you had a little boat, you could go along the coastline without having to navigate the seas. But lots of different positive things happen being when you have an accurate picture of the world. It's this is kind of this whole legacy. It's in that same vein.
Isn't that amazing that a shift in perspective could be something as simple as presenting the globe through a more accurate
And even the like, because it looks so different, so radically different, you don't easily identify nation states anymore. And the Mercator projection map, which is our traditional, United States classroom map, obviously, North America, the United States is in the middle, and then like Africa's over on the right, separated from us by the Atlantic Ocean, and Asia's over on the left, separated by the Pacific Ocean. So this idea of us and them, and we're separated by these vast oceans, is really kind of like hammered in. It's like these ideas of scarcity. There's not enough to go around, and da da da. And if someone's going to take our beans or whatever, ideas and go away. When you see this map, those nation states are kind of obliterated. It's hard to identify, and it's really just one landmass and one ocean that we walked across and populated and spent different times in different parts to become more or less melanated And so it's ideas of global unity aren't just some moral imperative or some wishy-washy fuzzy concept. It's like, no, it's real. It becomes very real. It hits home. And efforts to divide us and operate within scarcity and fear-based mode aren't just some kind of fanciful metaphysical speculation anymore. It's like, no, that's really what we're up against. That and unfortunately, in 2025, you see the concept of globalization demonized a lot. And understandably, I mean, if there was some sort of global cooperation around resources, dark forces could get a hold of that and use that power to enrich themselves all too often. That But it feels like something we have to figure out, Again, like controlling the narrative around that is probably what needs to happen.
Yeah, the only negative thing I see around globalization is how capitalism has fueled so much consumption and so much exploitation. We want to be able to, it's such a gift that we're connected now with each other. The problem is that some of the connection comes with just this completely unnecessary production and extraction of resources. And we were talking about Bucky's notion of spontaneous collaboration. It reminded me of something else he said, which was to do more and more with less and less until you can eventually you can do everything with nothing.
That the term he gave to that was ephemeralization.
Ooh.
Yeah, that was one of his neologisms, new wordsy. His thinking went so far out that he needed to create new words in order to
Ah.
Yep, ephemeralization. And I mean, you certainly see it showing up in technology, doing more and more with less and less and less there. It takes less to achieve, miracles with technology than it did when, 50 years ago. And the dome itself is an example. The geodesic dome is an example of ephemeralization in that it uses the least amount of material to enclose a volume of space architecturally because it imitates natural growth patterns that are expressed in things like RNA virus shell construction, so it th that passed through the crucible of evolution from for millions, possibly billions of years. When you build that way, you're building in alignment with that, and it is efficient or ephemeral, ephemeralized. I love that idea, though. Yeah, you can do everything with nothing. It's hard to get your head around, but
It
that's where.
is. Well, especially in a system where we're just so used to everything being like capitalism necessitating more, more, more versus less, 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 like planned obsolescence, so you can just buy something else instead of like something that you buy and then it works forever. Or like, we need to extract more gas because we need to fuel more cars and da 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 versus the concept of like free energy.
It's we only lack the will to do it. And that's where kind of like controlling the narrative of what is or isn't possible shapes the future, if we're living in a world where that's not possible. I mean, that's what all these kind of things like the World Resource Simulation Center and the World Game and his other concept of the geoscope that we're all kind of reactivating down there at SIU is the underlying message is like we can make it work for everybody if we chose to. We don't have to have this strife and conflict. There's enough to go around. There's enough free energy, clean energy to do anything we want if we just do things like, say, when one hemisphere is in darkness and the other is light, that you have a global power grid that moves energy where it needs to be used or isn't being used. I mean, that level of that globalization is the type of globalization. You know what I mean? That's this exporting of Western values and obliterating, cultures, homogenizing. It's tragic. I hate it. It's like, so sad. It's it's just terrible. But I don't that version of globalization is regrettable and awful. You know, the globalization version where you cooperate to share resources is the beneficial one. So I don't know, figuring out how to get there. It gets into the utopian thinking category, but it's worth reaching for, I think. If we're going to make it as a species, we're kind of there, you know. It's going to happen inevitably, so managing it correctly is up to us.
Well, I think Bucky was on the money when he said we don't change anything by fighting the existing reality. We change it by
Right.
building a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. But that's difficult when so many people are being hurt and harmed, and there's just so much wrong going on. But we recognize that we're feeding those monsters by fighting them. But there has to be some way that's because people just don't have the capacity to build the new. They don't have the capacity to step outside because we're struggling to survive under this model. So that's why I turned from climate change to alchemy. And I'm like, how can I fix the inner? Because I certainly can't fix the outer, but it's some space in between, and it's coming together in community and finding that spontaneous collaboration. I think letting it emerge, and yeah, finding these ways to rebuild, to like reimagine, to transmute, like you taking that orange crush sign and turning it into art. Not you said in your talk that 50% of landfills are old, like construction materials.
Yeah, that was something like, I built this way for my personal reasons, but then, I started doing the research around 06 or so. Then this green building data came out, and I got asked to talk to a sociology class at SIU about green building and the sociological impact of it. And I didn't know what that was, so I had to do the research on it. But and then I was just shocked to learn it was 40 something percent of the volume of landfills is construction and demolition waste. So, I mean, that's a huge place to be able to make an impact. Just, being more efficient in that process. And, I mean, we have to acknowledge, it's challenging. Like, I got acreage here in Illinois, and my family, my ancestor was here in the 1800s when it was territory and was a land surveyor, which is appealing to me because of the triangulation. But, we're here on indigenous land and native land, and, I'm trying to be a responsible land manager, but at the end of the day, that is always kind of looming in the back of my mind, like just the onerous idea of property ownership is like bad. You know what I mean? Like, so much of the things that are just built into the way we function now are just make it hard to really reach that level of change. And like you were mentioning earlier with that Bucky quote, "Don't fight the existing model, build its replacement." That's very appealing to me. I took that on almost like a mantra. But for Bucky and me both, as European ancestry, white people in, the United States, him 20th century, us 21st century. Well, things may be changing now, but we've never had a government that didn't see us, white men, as completely full human beings. If our government, didn't see us or anyone as a complete and full human being, you may need to fight that government. You may not just get away with building, you know what I mean? Like, and I want that to be the solution because that's my natural impulse, is to build a house. But what am I, I'm still building a permanent residence on stolen land. Wah, wah, wah. You know what I mean? Like, we should be, it's just not, we can't, I don't know if we can or can't, but I mean, Bucky wanted architecture to be transportable. You know what I'm saying? Like that tied in with his whole ephemeralization idea. He wanted his structures to be transportable, where we were almost kind of going back to this nomadic thing without property ownership. He was getting the military to fly geodesic dome tents by helicopter into combat areas. He wanted his early 1920s Dymaxion 4D house designs to be deliverable by Zeppelin, or you have like a Zeppelin docking station at the top that, it's like you put a mast up and it sits down on this mast wherever it's at. But there's a, I hate to say it, but that my mantra of like build the model to replace the existing reality may not be viable for everyone. There may be a need to have to fight or confront the existing reality that you don't like. So it's a tough realization to have to come to.
Well, hopefully we can integrate part of his understanding, which was to use the forces. So even if we're fighting the existing reality, to use the forces of nature and community, and with the goal of using less, exploiting less, extracting less, and yeah, do what we need to do from where we're at in our lived experience. 'Cause I agree, I talk about these things and then I hear myself and I'm like, well, that's just not true for everybody. And
Yeah.
it's not true for me either, because I still continue to less and less fight the existing structure, just 'cause I see the futility in it from my lived experience. It's different for everyone, obviously, but yeah, to use the forces and to use each other to come deeper and deeper into community, because we don't know what's next. We know that this unraveling and this cataclysm and this expansion is going to continue, but we don't know where it's going to land. Well, it's never going to land. It's just going to continue.
Right, yeah. And that's what you're saying right there speaks to this idea of like how, the ephemeralization eventually leads to a point of doing everything with nothing. And that goes right even back to the kind of the alchemical, that is the philosopher's stone. You know what I'm saying? Like that is the we that's that aspect of reality that we can't get our head around. What is doing everything with nothing? What is the nothing is the continuous evolutionary process of relationship and ideas. That's non-material. That's non-physical. Ideas, thoughts, emotion, love. These are that's the nothing. No thing. Not no. Is no. It's not a. Those aren't things. And those are the closest to that unmanifested source of creation that the material and the thing world responds to these predictable proportions, but that no thing is that. I mean, yeah, I mean, getting having being in alignment with that can never be wrong, build, yeah, build the model that makes the existing one obsolete. It's like, I don't know, maybe if you were to do that from a position of love, which, Buckminster Fuller said, love is metaphysical gravity. So, it's the thing that draws things together on a metaphysical plane, the creative force. Like, if you built with love primarily, maybe you would create the model that was so attractive that, and the attention, you didn't give the attention to the other, what you don't like, that it would wither away and die like advertising that no one was paying attention to, maybe. But that could be, like you say, may not be for everyone. People have immediate needs. Their personal life and safety is being threatened. You may have to fight in that case.
Well, I just got lost in thought as you were talking about the situation in Palestine and people who are living under a just horrific oppression. And it's like they can't build a new reality when they're being bombed. Like,
Right? Yeah, right. Well, how does that apply there? Yeah. Yeah.
how do you fight back? It's just like, October 7th happened. It was this retaliation against decades of, and it's like they're. Methodology was to alert the world, and it did, and it opened us up. And so it's like, I think things are going to continue unfolding and the destruction is going to continue to happen, and that we can hold that this notion of building the new world like lightly. We have to hold everything lightly and gently, I think, and to maybe do it from a place of this alchemical center where it's like we're taking the shame and blame out of it, and we're just saying like, this is the way things are, and I'm going to move forward. Because I see a lot of people, like, we want to point a finger at an individual, and that takes us away from the whole lineage that led us here. So maybe finding the granularity in that. And for anyone who feels like they can pivot and build the new thing, that's amazing. But for anyone who's in the fight, just finding ways to remove feeding the demiurge, remove feeding that machine of destruction while they're fighting, and find ways to like fight from love and joy and in community. And you see that all the time. Bayo Akamolafe, the Nigerian philosopher, says this. He's like, the revolution needs to be sexier.
I agree. Yeah, that's that idea of like using those tools of communication that people who are liars use, but on behalf of truth and true data and accurate data, I think is what he's getting at with that. And it's funny, like we've kind of boiled this all down to the two, again, within the alchemical tradition, it's, you know, this building and destroying dichotomy. I want to focus on building. I think that the destruction, like just like the art practice, like I'm cutting up, I'm destroying this the advertising in an intentional way, and then building out of it. Like maybe in everything that we're talking about, societal, that destruction component is necessary on this plane of existence. This is just we're in, you know, seems like a dualistic thing, something about crossing the threshold into human existence, the dualism. Is up to this point, at least in our evolution, dualism is like bedrock of our consciousness or human understanding, and that building and destroying or creating and, you know, taking apart are the primary aspects of dualism, even more so than good and evil. Like that's totally sub good and evil is not real, you know what I mean? Like I hate to say that. But building and destroying could be good replacements for, you know what I'm saying? Like we've got chickens. I just looked out the window and saw, you know, I've got chickens. And foxes eat them sometimes, but which is feels destructive, right? To what we have built. But if you put your mind in the cozy little fox den and there's like hungry little baby foxes, then that's not that they're building. Their act of destruction, from my perspective, is their act of building. And that's probably the whole gamut. You know, it's like integrating that dualistic thinking is probably where we need to get but for now, yeah, building and destroying is what it all kind of seems to boil down to. We need both, probably. We probably need both.
Birth and
And
death, like
there it is. Yep.
that's it. Yeah, we would lack meaning. We would just be back in that like suspended source.
Literally, and a lot of smart, very smart people have said that it's the definition of unconsciousness. Like if you're not, you're undifferentiated, non-individuated. It's like without that, when you leave that, you enter this from holistic to dualistic. And because we are in physical bodies, we chose to enter into dualistic reality. And so we get to sit here because we wanted to have this conversation, right? We wanted to say, is it better to build or to destroy? You know, it's like, oh, we need both. You know, it's like they're the same thing. Yeah, that's it. I mean, and that's kind of like, you know, doing everything with nothing. You know, it's like it always it's this is basically the thesis, right, of our discussion here probably. And that's what Bucky analyzed, studied, measured the world to come to the conclusion that it is only a process. There is nothing there. There are no solids. It is only dynamic relationships and processes. It's so, yeah, that's hard for us to accept, but I loved, he also said, you know, that old expression, like it came to pass, like as in that it happened. He kind of adapted that in his poetic way and said, it came to pass and not to stay, in that it, you know, it's, this is all just transitory and dynamic and changing. So, yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
This, I feel that feels like the perfect place to wrap this up. This has been so enriching and illuminating.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. It's been fun to chat with you. These ideas don't just get to rattle around in my brain and drive me crazy and distract me. It's fun to share. It's why we showed up, right? In material form to share and do stuff like this.
Absolutely, to investigate and find our way back to their, like, oh, it just all is okay.
Yep. How long did it take us? It only took us, what, an hour and a half or something?
It's perfect, easy,
Yeah.
casual.
Yeah,
Do you have any art shows coming up? I know you're working on this dome, the
I there. Well, I have some work on view right now in Santa Monica at BG Gallery. It's yeah, BG Gallery in Santa Monica. I'm going to be back at PRS in LA April 24th to talk about sacred geometry and a lot of the stuff we touched on here today. And yeah, at fullerdome.org is where we're creating this programming around resurrecting those ideas of Bucky's and global unity in collaboration with the Buckminster Fuller Institute and the estate of Buckminster Fuller. And yeah, so that's the 90th day of the year, March 31st. 90th day on the 90th meridian.
so cool.
Right on.